from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A major part of the American dream once centered on owning a home. But then the housing crisis hit in 2008, ripping away that dream for millions of Americans. A little more than a decade later, home sales have rebounded. On the one hand, today's buyers are smarter about the potential risks, but in some of the hottest markets around the country, ownership is now out of reach. So what about renting? Well, some landlords are offering rentals with perks. We're talking things like free coffee and Wi-Fi. But we're wondering, where does all this real estate disruption leave the American dream? So this hour on Point, our special series, Where We Call Home. It's part three, and we're looking at renting versus buying. And you can join the conversation. What does home ownership mean to you? Are you renting by choice right now or by necessity? And do you still think owning a home lies at the heart of the American dream? And if it doesn't anymore, why? And what does that mean? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, first, what we're going to do today is we're going to check in with two cities about what their housing markets are like right now. Very different stories on the rent versus buy question. Joining us from Grand Rapids, Michigan is Sine Jordan, a realtor for Keller Williams Realty in Grand Rapids. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And also with us from Austin, Texas, is Kevin Scanlon, president of the Austin Board of Realtors and owner of All City Real Estate in Austin, Texas. Kevin, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you both. And Sine, if I just may start with you right now, how would you describe what the housing market is like in Grand Rapids, Michigan today?
Well, currently we're experiencing a low inventory in the housing market. However, there's a lot of construction happening with apartments and lofts, affordable homes. So it's a changing market. The housing market is very low, though.
Okay, so low inventory, meaning there's demand for that inventory, though.
There is a great demand for housing. So in 2018, the housing market started. You know, we kind of plateaued, and we listed maybe a little over 15,000 homes for sale in Grand Rapids. However, right now, it doesn't look that way. We're kind of plateaued out there.
Okay. So are you seeing, in terms of, let's talk about first-time home buyers here for a second, right? Because they're the ones who usually, they can't afford the homes at the middle or the top of the market here. Are those potential first-time home buyers, are they kind of being squeezed out of Grand Rapids at the moment as for home ownership and are having to look towards renting more than you've seen in the past?
They actually are looking more towards renting only because there's a lot of options available for renting now. And the accessibility, the housing is the market is where at a medium, so where the rental is a little more pricey in the inner city. But if you're looking on the suburbs, it's a little more affordable. But in the inner city, there's more amenities, available to the renters. So people aren't minding renting. However, the housing price between a two-bedroom to a four-bedroom has skyrocketed, and people aren't able to afford them.
Wow. Okay. So Kevin Scanlon in Austin, Texas here. What parts of what Sine Jordan is describing as and the Grand Rapids market, does any of that sound familiar to what you're seeing in Austin?
Very familiar. Very familiar indeed. We've seen very large increases in demand over the last 6 to 8 years. We began to emerge from the housing crisis in 2011, 2012, and by 2013, we were experiencing large increases in the rates of appreciation. The inventory began to shrink dramatically, and multiple offer situations were really the order of the day, and that's continued unabated for the last several years.
Oh, it's so stressful, those multiple offer situations. I mean, how are you advising potential buyers who, the lure to stay out of those bidding wars, it should be strong. But then again, like the lure to buy a house is potentially even stronger.
Austin has become such a desired destination for not only renters and homeowners, consumers, but also for businesses. Apple is going to be building a new campus and is expected to inject billions of dollars into the Austin economy, 5,000 new jobs, and the high-tech industry in Austin has once again become quite a boon for our economy. And that bodes well for our economic base for the next 5, 10, 20 years, which in all probability will help to keep our housing market stable. So those buyers who may be a little hesitant to dive into a multiple offer situation should know, and it's a difficult job sometimes to educate them, that this is unlikely to change for the foreseeable future because we have such a broad economic base in Austin and Central Texas in general.
Yeah. Well, Sione Jordan, let me turn back to you here because I'm still thinking about, the story that Kevin's telling about Austin on the one hand is great, right? Because when you have a region that's growing and people want to live there, that's what we all want. But on the other hand, when you're working with potential buyers who come to the point where they're ready to dive in, don't those same high costs make it tougher to get mortgages, tougher to be able to save for those down payments? I mean, what are the big financial challenges that buyers are presenting you with when they're ready to dive in?
So they are looking at, you know, there's a problem when it comes to getting pre-approved for a house. But there's other options that are available here in Grand Rapids. So we're also very desired area to live in. There's a lot of opportunity in the city of Grand Rapids. So the city is creating ways for people to be able to afford housing. They've been very intentional about reaching out. There's been so Dwelling Place and Habitat for Humanity and ICCF are all resources that our housing market have been assisting, you know, our housing market for affordable homes for people. And they are creating ways for them to be able to get pre-approved. There are classes and resources available to assist them. And it's been a blessing for people in the city of Grand Rapids that have a desire to become homeowners. We are creating ways. There are resources available that will assist them along the way. We have a very great intentional group of realtors that are very experienced and educated with helping work with their buyers. So it's been a great experience. I feel like, you know, those who desire to become homeowners have a great opportunity right here in Grand Rapids.
Okay, well, so that's good news there in Grand Rapids. But Kevin Scan, let me turn back to you. In Austin, Texas, we've been focusing a lot on sort of the buying side of the equation, but I got to ask you about what the effects of the very hot market in Austin have had on the rental side of the equation. I mean, I didn't hear you say that there's been this enormous building boom that's sort of taken the edge off the rental market. I mean, how much have monthly rents increased in Austin recently?
I don't have the figures in front of me, but I would say a safe guess over the last several years would be a 20 to 30% increase in rental rates. Austin, Greater Austin, has experienced over the last several years consistent growth with more than 150 consumers, 150 people moving to Greater Austin every single day, according to the Chamber of Commerce. And what that has created is a shortage not only in homes for sale, but in the rental community as well. And it's not uncommon for a mortgage on a home to be several hundred dollars a month less than what you would pay for a comparable home in rent per month.
Uh-huh.
And so it's really created quite a demand for both single-family rental properties, but also large complexes of apartments, which are going up all over the place. The downtown Austin skyline has morphed over the last 10 years and is unrecognizable. And we like to say that the new state bird, in Austin at least, is the crane, because there are just dozens of cranes when you look at the skyline and the building. There's a frenzy that's been going on for several years and doesn't appear to be slowing down.
Well, a point taken about how rents, monthly rents can compete with monthly mortgages now. But of course, as we keep mentioning, there's still those challenges of having enough for a down payment, or even if you have a lower percentage down payment, achieving the financing to buy the house. I mean, Sine Jordan, got a couple of, just a minute and a half here left before we have to take a quick break. I know I'm talking to two realtors here. I just want to once again acknowledge that to everyone. But I'm wondering, as you've seen the market in Grand Rapids change and the challenges that buyers and renters have, do you still see home ownership as a really important part of achieving the American dream?
I do believe it's a very important part of achieving that dream. And being intentional about creating ways in our city has been very important to our mayor and our city manager. They are really intentional about, you know, working with the resources we have and finding others to make that happen for people. However, we do see that now that the medical marijuana has been approved in our city, you know, it's looking and feeling a little different for people. There's a lot of things that, so it depends on people are designing where they want to live, so they'll have opportunities. We have opportunities. Zones that exist here where people are able to take advantage of certain, you know, abatements. And so people are really looking at, our city is really looking at creating ways for people to become, that desire to have children, that want to become homeowners, that want to create a legacy, to be able to make that happen.
I see.
For,
Well, so Sine Jordan, a realtor for Keller Williams Realty in Grand Rapids, Michigan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Kevin Scanlon, broker and owner of All City Real Estate and president of the Austin Board of Realtors in Austin, Texas. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we're talking this hour about renting versus buying in part three of our special series, Where We Call Home. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about renting versus buying in part three of our special series, Where We Call Home. And we're taking a look at whether home ownership is still central to the American dream, or whether, given the financial crash of 2008 and other shifts in the American economy, whether renting is the smarter way to go in certain American housing markets. And let's listen to a little bit about how the housing market is talked about in popular television. Here's Paige Turner and Daron Jenkins. They're the hosts of HGTV's Flip or Flop Nashville. And in this scene from an episode, they travel to the South Nashville neighborhood of Woodbine to check out a listing.
I like Woodbine a lot.
Yeah, it's cute. Yeah. You know, they have a lot of homes over there, ranch, all brick. You know, a lot of buyers are flocking to the neighborhood because it's become a little hot spot in Nashville. So I'm excited to see what this one looks like. It's 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, about 1,100 square feet. But it also has an unfinished walkout basement.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a good-sized basement, then the $205,000 price point will make sense.
That's Paige Turner and Daron Jenkins from HGTV's Flip or Flop. And voila, in the magic of television, I guess they flip it to a house that they sell to a new buyer. So joining us now is Ryan Dezember. He's with us from New York. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and writes about the housing market as well. And he's writing a book now about his own experience as an underwater homeowner and landlord during the housing crisis. Ryan Dezember, welcome to you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Also with me in the studio today is Chris Herbert. He is Managing Director of the Joint Housing Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Chris, welcome to you.
Magda, it's great to be with you.
Okay, Ryan, let me just start with you because we played that fun little clip there from Flip or Flop on HGTV talking about South Nashville. Nashville's an area that you've done some reporting on regarding their real estate market there. Is it a great place for people who are seeking to own a home, or does it feel the same pressures as we heard from Grand Rapids and Austin in terms of the shifting housing market?
Oh, yeah. So Nashville's one of the hotter markets around. It's become pretty difficult for a lot of people to buy houses. It has some of the same problems with, shortage of inventory that Grand Rapids has. One of the really interesting things that sort of sent me to Nashville, and specifically the southern suburbs of Nashville, is that this was a place where the Wall Street investors who started buying houses sort of en masse at the depths of the foreclosure crisis were buying a lot of houses there well after the foreclosure crisis had sort of subsided. And they continue to buy there, and they're buying these homes to rent because Nashville has sort of all the ingredients you look for. It has a lot of people moving there. It has job growth. It has, especially in the southern suburbs, very good schools. So these buyers, these Wall Street firms, their algorithms will sort of sort through all the data and say, buy the houses here. These are the cheapest houses in the best school district where there's, you know, great population and jobs growth. And we found this town, Spring Hill, where there's a GM plant. They used to make Saturns there, and it used to be farmland, and now it's a place where, 5% or more of the houses are owned by four companies that rent these houses. Tremendous growth, sort of pushing the boundaries of the metropolitan area. And what we found was people that were trying to buy houses would run into these Wall Street buyers who pay all cash, don't require an appraisal or anything. And they were like losing these bidding wars and then turning around and having to rent these homes.
That is astounding. I mean, but also not entirely right. Unfamiliar. But you have having algorithmic buying from Wall Street presenting. How much is it shaping the market here? I mean, how many people, how many actual individuals or families is it locking out of home ownership?
Well, it's hard to say how many it's locking out of home ownership, but these firms are buying, they need thousands of homes in an area to make it efficient, right? To manage and maintain all these sort of far-flung homes. It's a lot different than buying an apartment complex where you have, 100 units under one or a few roofs. You've got thousands of roofs. You have to go around and repair those. So you need a certain density. So it's hard to say how many of those homes would have been, or how many people lost out. But, as they're buying on the open market, they're usually not the only offer, right? There's usually, we did a story and
yeah, but they're the ones
couple.
Presenting. I'm sorry, Red, but they're the ones presenting the all cash, no contingency offers,
right? And no seller's going to say, well, I'd really like to give it to this young couple with the baby, but we're going to see if they qualify for a mortgage. Things might fall apart. They're going to take that cash. So they really are like a really unbeatable sort of opponent in a bidding war.
Okay, so Chris Herbert, first of all, just react to what Ryan's saying about kind of this new kind of buyer that's on the market here. Are the fundamentals of the housing market now different enough or significantly different from what they were pre-2008 so that this question of renting versus buying for a lot of people may not even come down to what they can afford, but other bigger factors?
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue that Ryan's pointing to is what's happening on the supply side, not so much at what consumers are deciding. And the big difference is that we do have investors now who are playing in the single-family rental market in a significant way. Ryan's talking about big Wall Street firms who are certainly significant in places like Nashville. But there's a lot of mom-and-pop investors, too, who have moved into this space in the market. And so between 2007 and about 2017, we saw 4 million single-family homes shift from being owner-occupied to renter-occupied. And so we thought for a time that that would be something that would be a relatively temporary shift. But in fact, I think a lot of folks have found that this is a good investment and are staying there. So I think it's not so much a question on the first-time home buyer, do they want to buy? But they do now have a new competitor, which are these investors. And it's Wall Street, and it's also smaller-scale investors who are getting into this.
So the 4 million single-family homes that shifted from ownership to rental, though, did we have a similar 4 million additional new homes being built?
We have not been building a lot of new homes. And so if you look right now, we're building about 800,000 single-family homes, and we're now 10 years post-crash. That would have been not a good year in previous years. And so we're very slowly coming back to building single-family homes. And the homes we're building are bigger. We're not building entry-level homes for the first-time buyers.
So are we seeing at the most fundamental level, I mean, we're trying to shape this out around the question about, you know, yes, what are the challenges that people have to face when deciding whether to rent or buy? But also, is home ownership, is the choice to buy still central to achieving the American dream, quote unquote, the American dream? I mean, if we're seeing more people having to go towards renting, mm-hmm. what is your answer to that question?
You know, I'm an economist, so the answer is always it depends. and I don't want to – but I think the issue is if you're in a certain phase of life where you're going to have stable income, you're going to want to stay in one place for a long time. The thing about homeownership, it's risky, right? Prices go up and down. It's not only risky, it also costs a lot to buy and sell homes. So you don't want to buy a home if you're not intending to be there for, rule of thumb, 5 to 7 years, because you need to be able to accommodate the transaction costs of buying and selling and ride out those ups and downs. That said, I would say that that it still remains an important part, what I would describe as a household's basis for financial security and household stability. So when you're a homeowner, it's not only is it an investment, it's your home. And when you're an owner, you get to call the shots. How long are you going to stay there? What, you know, can you fix it up? Can you change it to suit your needs and preferences? And so I think that that issue of being able to call a place home, to be able to control it and be able to build up financing security over time is still an important piece of it.
Yeah. So Ryan December, what's you've been reporting on this for a while. What's your answer to that same question?
Well, I think Chris is right that you sort of have to consider, like, am I going to be here for a long time? Because the cost, you know, you can buy a house, and if you have to move in 2 years and sell it, you're going to have to come up with 6% to pay the realtor. It may be more for all the costs, you know, all in. So you're going to have to hope your home is appreciated that much, or you're going to be writing a check to get out of it. And that's something, you know, without prices, you know, moving down, which I personally got caught in that. You buy a house and then all of a sudden, whoa, wait, what happened? Why are the houses worth, you know, less than it costs to build them? Why did they fall 50%? And I think that sort of, that event sort of like shook up things in terms of putting that in mind. That hadn't right. happened, at least in decades or generations, where all the houses fell in price. You know, some areas like where I lived in South Alabama and like Phoenix and Las Vegas, where all of a sudden you're talking like 50-60% price declines really rapidly. So I would think that's sort of like one of the things you have to consider. Are you going to be there long enough for like this all to average out and for you to sort of just be able to get out of it with, you know, paying the costs and clearing the mortgage, which can be a challenge. You know, sometimes we hear in hot markets, oh, you know, home prices are rising 10 or 20% a year. Well, that's sort of rare, and I wouldn't count on that.
Right.
And the other thing, too, is like, you know, you get a job, you don't, people don't stay and move in and work for one company for 30 years. That's pretty rare these days.
Well, Chris Herbert, what do you think about that? I mean, I take Ryan's point about the our now officially decade-long awareness about major movements up or down in the housing market. But the other issues that Ryan was talking about, you know, like you've got to – if do you know if you're going to live somewhere for more than a couple years? Can you bear the cost of selling in terms of fees, commissions, et cetera? But those issues have always been in place for homeowners, and still it didn't really dissuade people from buying in years or decades or generations past.
No, that's true. They have always been in place. And I think, you know, Ryan described the incredible downturn we had in housing prices and during the housing crash. And it was fairly unprecedented. It was unprecedented mostly in the fact that it happened across the whole country for the most part. We don't have to go very far in the Boston area. Look back to the late 1980s when we had a pretty significant crash then as well. So to some extent, in many parts of the country, they had not experienced that significant downturn.
Uh-huh.
And so that was new. But I think that it's always been the case that homeownership has been a risky investment, and that you have to have the ability to withstand those vicissitudes of life and your finances over time. You know, so I think you definitely want to go into homeownership with some ability to withstand a shock.
Right.
And so that means that you have to have some savings and some other ways to accommodate.
And so this is the big question now. Have many Americans who maybe their parents had that ability to withstand small shocks, have they lost that ability, Ryan? Is that part of the issue here about why so many people don't even have a choice and just renting is their primary option because of, I don't know, student loans, job insecurity, increased costs of health care, like anything that you can point your finger to that has now been foisted on individual Americans is what's making it harder for them to achieve home ownership.
Well, yeah, I think, and you mentioned it, like student debt is the big thing, right? I mean, we've seen household debt has generally increased. So second quarter of 2004, when the home ownership rate peaked just above 69%, and that was, you know, historically an anomaly, you had, $6.3 trillion in housing debt. You had $2 trillion or so in non-housing debt. Non-housing debt is basically doubled. Student loan debt is up sixfold, almost sixfold from then to about $1.5 trillion, up from about $250 billion. And that's in, you know, call it 14 years to now. We saw it a couple summers ago. Fannie Mae increased the debt to income ratios that they would accept up to 50% in some cases. Now, for those people, you have to have like good credit. You have to have money down. You have to have all these other boxes checked. But that's sort of unheard of. I was trying to put that into context, and I called my mother, who sold homes in the 80s and 90s in Cleveland, and asked her, what was the debt-to-income ratio that you worked with? And it was 28%.
Wow.
So we've seen sort of the, you know, like the accommodations being made and sort of the acknowledgement in housing policy in the country to accommodate this tremendous student debt. Chris's organization put out an interesting report, and I may have the numbers slightly off, but it was something like 2006, before the crash, there were about 12% of the people that had a household income of $100,000 or up that were renters. You know, 10 years later, that had risen by a third. That's like 18%. So you're having people come out of college with good jobs and good wages, but they're just like really shackled with debt. And that's been a major component of all this.
Well, we are going to definitely talk more about that in just a second, but I should let our callers in here because, you know, it's you out there who were asking this question of how do you make the decision between renting and buying when it comes to where you're going to live? And do you still see home ownership as central to the American dream? Let's go to Eric, who's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. So I think this is a great conversation, and you actually just hit on one of the major points that I wanted to make, which is student loans are really a huge factor in this. For my wife and I, we lived in the Boston area, and part of it is that people are just getting priced out of the city. And even in the closer suburbs, you have people bringing cash offers, waiving inspection, waiving appraisal, which for first-time home buyers, that is really quite a challenge. Especially given the shortage of inventory and the shortage of starter homes, that those just really don't exist anymore. So for my wife and I, coming to your topic of, you know, this being part of the American dream, our decision was that we had to have some trade-offs. So we were fortunate enough that we were able to stay with my in-laws for a few years while we saved up a substantial down payment. And once we did that, we even opted to stay out of the city because Boston is frankly just too expensive, regardless of if you have two professionals who have good paying jobs. It's just really out of reach for most people nowadays.
Right. So, well we Eric, thank you so much for your call, Eric. Chris Herbert, what do you think about Eric's comment there? Especially, you know, he and his wife decided to make some trade-offs in order to achieve home ownership, and it has worked for them.
Yeah, so there's a few themes in there, and so we can maybe we'll come back to the student loans.
Yes.
But it's obviously a factor that is at least delaying access to homeownership because you have to pay those off. It makes it harder to save and the like. But I think Eric raises a really interesting question, which is, you know, when people talk about millennials, will they own? And part of what they point to is the fact that young people are moving into cities, and they love living in cities, and they want to stay in the city. And the issue is, as Eric described, is that in the city it can be really expensive to get into the homeowner market. Prices are high. And so then the question is, you face that trade-off. How much do I want to own? And am I willing to sacrifice where I live in order to get the kind of house that I want to get? And Eric and his wife obviously made that trade-off. And I think we're at a point where we're trying to decide, will this millennial generation, will they make that trade-off? Or will some of them decide, I can't afford to buy, but I want to stay in the city, and so I'm going to stay a renter for however long.
Mm. And I mean, in terms of the long-term wealth building or intergenerational wealth building, do you think it's a trade-off worth making?
You know, so my sense of this is that we have not yet as a society figured out a better means of helping people build wealth, particularly low and moderate income households and racial minorities than home ownership.
Right.
That begs a question about what else we could do. But this is a show about home ownership. And I think, you know, home ownership with the right guardrails, meaning that you go into it with the kind of safety cushion we were talking about earlier to withstand those shocks, over the long run is proven to be and remains, I think, a fundamental way of building wealth.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe we ought to do another hour about this, but what you said is exactly true. It has been the primary model in this country for generations. And if we don't have something else to offer people, they seem more than a little stuck. So Chris Herbert and Ryan Dezember, stand by here for just a second. We're talking this hour about part three of our special series, Where We Call Home, and the question of renting versus buying and how you make that decision in 2019, given America's various housing markets. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, it's part three of our special series, Where We Call Home, and we're taking a look at the question of renting versus buying and whether or not home ownership is still at the heart of the American dream. And, you know, we put out a survey to On Point listeners, non-scientific survey, I should add here, on various questions about home ownership. And one of them was, do you agree or disagree with this statement that a big part of the American dream is owning a home? And of the almost 1,200 responses we got, 79.3% of people said yes, they agree with that statement. A big part of the American dream is owning a home. And, you know, we've also been hearing from listeners over the course of the past couple of weeks through voice messages that they've been sending us. Here's Peter Parsons. He's an On Point listener who's a native of Gloucester, Massachusetts. He still lives there today. And he talked about how the faltering commercial fishing industry that once supported Gloucester, Massachusetts, has led to a major change in housing prices.
That fact lends to the pressures of gentrification, because people who benefited for generations from commercial fisheries and the related industries can no longer make a really secure living here. So natives, and I can feel this myself, are being pressured to leave the place because they can't afford to live here anymore.
That's Peter Parsons from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Different story from an On Point listener in Buffalo, New York, Elizabeth Giles. She left us a voice memo about how she's enjoying the affordable nature of Buffalo and the fact that she can also afford to really enjoy all the city has to offer.
I have married friends in their 40s and 50s living in Boston, Chicago, London, where it's too crowded to easily enjoy the amenities those cities have. And the cost of living is so high that even without kids, they can't afford to buy a modest house. I keep wondering when people are going to get over living in places that have a cool brand name, but are in fact pretty difficult to live in once you're too old to enjoy, you know, flopping with housemates in a tiny flat or moving way out to the suburbs with a brutal commute.
And that's On Point listener Elizabeth Giles in Buffalo, New York. I'm joined this hour by Chris Herbert. He's managing director of the Joint Housing Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. And Ryan Dezember is with us as well. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He writes about the housing market. Ryan, this issue about, Elizabeth's words, brand name places and the cost of living there. Chris actually pointed this out just before the break. I wanted to get your take on that. I mean, is it something that people are going to just have to give up living in the brand name place if they want to afford to become a buyer and no longer be a renter?
You know, that's possible. But I think, you know, one thing that she said was she's talking about people in their 50s and 60s.
Right.
Now, if you're coming out of college or you're in your 30s and you're trying to earn a living, you may not have a choice. You may have to live in a Denver or a New York or a San Francisco or an Austin, Texas, or even in Nashville where it's very hard. I mean, that's sort of why the houses are in such demand and why the prices are going up.
Well, let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Zach, who's calling from New Orleans. Zach, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well. What's your thought today?
So I just wanted to say that I am very much pro-renting as opposed to owning. I think that maybe geographically, due to where I'm located, being in New Orleans, something my wife and I have talked about quite a bit, is the whole commitment to owning property, especially property in an area that's not only prone to flooding, but an area that's also been predicted by some scientists that, you know, could be underwater in 50 years.
Uh-huh.
So not just with that in regard to the actual commitment of starting a family, you know, birth rates on the decline in the U.S., 2016, 2017, down 2%. I think millennials have an issue with, myself included. I mean, I may be an anomaly in the whole aspect of really looking at the prospect of climate change, determining whether I rent or buy, but really assessing that commitment based upon a long-term longevity of having that property intact
right.
with the environment around it. So
right. Well,
it's just a food for thought from, you know, somebody in their 30s. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Zach, actually, thank you so much for your call. Chris Herbert, what do you think, Zach, introducing in a lot of coastal cities in the United States, the potential for climate change making the value of their homes perhaps less than certain for 5, 10, 15 years down the line?
You know, absolutely. I guess that's another one to add to the risks of home ownership, right. Not just prices going up and down, but the sea level going up and down. And certainly, you know, I think it's very prudent to look at the 100-year floodplain, maybe the 1,000-year floodplain, given some of the experiences we've had before you buy a home. So another issue to factor in. But I'm sure there's places in New Orleans you could find that would be protected.
Yeah.
You know, and he raises the other point about, you know, his decision about whether to have a family and to what extent is homeownership tied in with that. And certainly, you know, people tend to tie the decision to buy to those life milestones. And having kids is usually a signal saying we're going to stay put, we're going to put down roots and be somewhere for a while. But you don't have to have a family to be a homeowner and to have roots and want to put down. So it doesn't have to be a decision about have kids, buy a home or not.
I see. Let's go to Kelly, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Kelly, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Go ahead.
Good. Well, it's funny. I just heard the clip that you had from Elizabeth talking about, you know, moving to places with a brand name. And that's not entirely true for the purpose of moving to a New York or a D.C. like we did prior to moving back to Buffalo or originally from here. Our careers took us there in our 30s. We're in our 40s now. And as far as having lived in New York City, astronomical rents, and also Washington, D.C., which are high rents, buying a home is ultimately just a financial decision. You can control your housing costs that way. We lived in New York during the housing crisis, and then after that crisis was over and the boom came, we saw our rents go up to, you know, high market rates. So for us, making the decision to buy a house was, okay, we're not going to have a $1,000 a month increase or a $500 a month increase because our neighborhood in Brooklyn has become hot again. So, you know, the question that I was talking, that I was trying to convey to the call screener was, you know, where are you seeing smaller markets like a Buffalo, New York? When you compare it to a New York City, it's apples and oranges.
Right.
The housing market is rising all the time and it's inaffordable. But what are you seeing in these smaller markets? A Cleveland? A Rochester, New York? A Buffalo, New York? That kind of thing. Is the, you know, the gap?
Right. So, Kelly, let me take it from you there and turn that to Ryan DeZember. And Ryan, I'll just sort of even broaden Kelly's question out a little bit because she mentioned a bunch of New York cities. But, you know, is it just much easier to buy homes in many other American markets? I mean, we've kind of been focusing a lot on the really hot urban markets now, which, of course, is not
right.
The totality of the country.
Well, you know, again, going back to sort of what the job situation is, I grew up in Cleveland. In Cleveland, you can buy a $100,000 house, right? No problem. A pretty good house. Well, The problem is, you know, do you have the same income? Okay, so that's a big issue. And, you know, one of the things that's come up in recent years is that the median income in just about every housing market can't afford the median home price.
Right.
And that's sort of, that's not just like a New York and a Seattle problem. That's like kind of all the way down.
Can we just say that again? That the median income in most American housing markets cannot afford the median home price. I just wanted to say that again. Is that not kind of a disturbing thing?
Yeah. I mean, that could be a big problem. And it goes back to sort of like this, you know, wealth generation. You know, most people aren't good at saving in America, but most people save by accident when they make their mortgage payment sort of every month. They're socking away into the equity. Now, will we have situations where like you have your parents or grandparents and they buy a house for $200,000 and then, you know, they sell it once all the kids are gone, it's $1 million. Will we have that kind of increase in the future? I don't know. That seems hard to envision, but that's like sort of the way that most people save. So, you know, you sort of get a generation or two off that sort of off that escalator, and you could have big problems in the future.
Exactly. So, Chris Herbert, let me turn back to you on this, because, again, I definitely see for a lot of people the near-term necessity and perhaps even advantages of renting, right? You're not dealing with the headaches of home ownership, maybe at a time in your life where it's more challenging. But it's this long-term loss that I think people remain concerned about. And Ryan just highlighted it. Like, in generations past, you get in for $100,000, you may get out for $1.5 million when you need the money in retirement.
Right.
Is that out of reach now for people?
Well, it increasingly is becoming out of reach in some of these markets, and I think it does have long-term implications. You know, I think it's this question about high cost versus low cost. You're living in Buffalo or Cleveland, you're not going to get that $1 million house appreciation. Is it worth buying? You know, you're not going to get that lottery ticket. So what I would say is that's the wrong way to think about it. And the fact is that most people, when they get to retirement, it's not like you suddenly get to retirement and you cash in your house and you go and you know, live on the high life, right? Most people stay in their houses well until later in life, and that's what they want to do. The main way you benefit from home ownership late in life is you live in it rent-free. So when you pay off that mortgage and every month you just sit there and you don't have to write a check to the bank or to a landlord, and that's an important dividend and one I think we need to pay more attention to, because unlike our parents' generation, we don't have defined benefit plans to look forward to when we retire. We have Social Security, hopefully. We have our 401k or 403b, whatever we put away. And if you're going to have financial security, you need to have three legs of a stool. And home ownership, free and clear home ownership, is the third leg of that stool. So the way that we ought to think about it is not whether I'm going to make $1 million in appreciation, but can I get to retirement, have my home paid off, and be able to live and cash that dividend check each month?
Well, but I know that, you know, over the years I've talked to many seniors who, yes, have paid their homes off, but in these hot housing markets where values are rising, they're having trouble making those property taxes, for example.
No, that is a big issue. You know, Peter Parsons from Gloucester, who left that message talking about not being able to afford it in Gloucester, that part of the reason may be those taxes are going up. And that, you know, there's other policies to address that. There are various kinds of circuit breakers for older folks to be able to get a rebate, you know, some break from their property taxes.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to Cindy, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi. I bought and sold many homes. I'm over 50 now, and I'm renting, and I like renting at this point in my life. I live alone. And I love those three little words when something goes wrong, not my problem. When the porch caves in or the gutters need cleaning or there's a problem with the roof, I just call somebody. I don't have to worry about having this big, savings to spend on that or spend my weekends doing those kinds of projects. I like having the time to myself.
I'm going to presume that your landlord responds to the calls in a timely manner, though, Cindy, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, I have a pretty good landlord.
Okay, great. Well, Cindy, thank you so much for your call. Again, there are associated responsibilities with home ownership that for a lot of people, they don't need it or want it in their lives, and renting works for them. So let's get a different view. Let's go to Gene, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Gene, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm not a real estate investor, but I own three homes. I'm a business consultant and moved around a lot. So I own a home in the San Francisco Bay Area, a duplex in Brooklyn, and a home in Miami. So what I'm finding is, in this whole conversation, that a little bit misses the point for me, because since I moved around in my job, I never rented, and I always purchased my home, kept it, and then rented it out. About a third of my income comes from rents, right? Income from rents.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also over 50. I look at it, it's definitely a part of my American dream. The rents that I collect are above what I would expect from Social Security and my 401k combined.
Right. Well, Gene,
yes.
No, go ahead. Last thought, and then I want to turn your story to Ryan. But go ahead.
This. I know some really smart people, and they don't know how to get advice about real estate. I taught myself, but there you can find a realtor, and good realtors are hard to find. But you find a good realtor, but that person's motivated by buying and selling. That's how they're paid. There's no consultancy for very smart people I work with who don't, they come to me and say, well, what should I do?
Yeah.
You know, I have a friend who works in New York City, earns over $220,000 a year, and he's rented for the past 22 years. His financial advisor says buy, and he doesn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no consultancy
right.
for people who are looking. And
well, Gene, thank you so much for your call. Ryan Dezember, I mean, Gene seems to, you know, has done it well. The Bay Area, Brooklyn, and Miami. So hats off to you,
Gene. Yeah, it's like
Gene.
The trifecta. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, but
we should all be so lucky.
He seemed to also say that, like, people who want to get into the market don't really know where to seek out good advice, or they're not getting advised well. That seemed a little strange to me because I think there's a lot of home ownership advice out there. But what do you think?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, more so than even advice. I mean, it's just sort of like influence. I mean, like, we have one of the most popular television channels in our country is HGTV, which is, you know, you played a clip to start this, you know, flipping and all that sort of thing. But I think the caller's right. I mean, if you can get homes and accumulate them and rent them out, you're really hitting on something. And we've seen, you know, the smart money on Wall Street has just really taken to that business in the last decade because of the crash and because the technology of smartphones and cloud computing allows them to sort of keep track of all of this. But, like, there's a reason they're doing that. And it's exceeded the sort of crash, oh, we can buy these cheap, rent them, and then sell them. Those people who lost homes to foreclosure, that's pretty much off their credit history. This is a long-term bet that this sort of rental class, this suburban rental class, will sort of stay swollen.
Okay, so Chris Herbert, we just got a minute left to go, and I want to get your view on this like really basic shift that Ryan's been describing to us. In the long run, is it good for these urban and suburban areas to have a permanently entrenched and growing rental class?
So I want to be careful not to denigrate renting. I mean, I think that renting, as you know, as Cindy, Kelly talked. Yeah. No, Cindy from Detroit was talking about the fact that, you know, renting comes with a lot of responsibilities, and you don't always want those. And there's lots of reasons why, when you're going to be moving back and forth, renting makes a lot more sense. But I would say that the fundamental issue that if people want to own, when you talk about a permanent rental class, if they're there because they want to rent, great. But if they want to own and they're blocked, then we got to find a way to get them a path into home ownership. Both because it provides a means of financial security and because it provides a means of residential security, insurance against gentrification and other factors. So we have to find a path for those who want it.
Well, Chris Herbert, Managing Director of the Joint Housing Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Ryan Dezember, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who writes about the housing market. Ryan, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, this was part 3 of our special series, Where We Call Home, talking a lot about urban and suburban areas. Next week in part 4, small town living. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. ¶¶